All right, welcome to the Money Lab Live Podcast, episode number 77, The Dark Side of Solving Problems with Money, Money Story. All right, that's enough of that. Welcome back to another live podcast broadcast of the Money Lab Podcast from the Six Figure Academy. I am your host, Wei Hong, from the Six Figure Academy, shaking it up a little bit and changing up our intro. Hopefully we don't get dinged for that, being on public domain with that amazing soundtrack that I actually just got to go see over at the Hollywood Bowl, The Empire Strikes Back, when the orchestra plays for it. So it's really cool. But anyway, this is the podcast where we give you tips, strategies, and interviews with other entrepreneurs on how to create that ultimate six-figure entrepreneurial lifestyle, free of bad money stories, money anxiety, and stress, so that you can monetize your dreams and execute your genius. Now, if you haven't already downloaded our free ebook, From Money Anxiety to Six-Figure Mastery, make sure you go to go.thesixfigureacademy.com and get it there. It's the perfect complement to all the things we discuss on the show, and quite frankly, it could change your life. Now, if you're joining us live today and you are not on YouTube Live, listening to that amazing song by John Williams and seeing our amazing guest, make sure you get on Spreaker.com, Spreaker.com, or download the Spreaker app on your mobile device and search for the hashtag TheMoneyLab, so that you can join us in the chat room, ask questions, and interact with us and our guests. Now, while you're there, subscribe so that you don't miss an episode and you can catch us every week. For all of the ways to find us, go to thesixfigureacademy.com/radio for all the details. And if there's something you love about what you hear on this episode today, which I can almost guarantee it because her and I talk the same language about money anxiety, and that you know could help someone who you care about, remember, sharing is caring. Share this episode with that person. Now, today's episode, by the way, is being sponsored by the Energy Mind Body Transformation Experience events, which run live, no pitch full day events, where the goal is to have that one shift, one transformational experience to help you optimize your energy, mind, and body. Go to www.embte, that's short for Energy Mind Body Transformational Experience, for more details on the upcoming events. Now, I'm really excited about our guest today. Not only because of the unique money story she brings to the table, but what you'll want to pay attention today to hearing about, and it's so in line with a lot of what I talk about with my students and clients, is she basically, you know, how she helps her audience end financial stress now, which is consequently the title of her new book. I like this because end financial stress now. Our show used to be called Stop Money Anxiety Now. Now it's called The Money Lab, but she has end financial stress now. And now how she, now also what you want to look for and listen for is how there is a dark side to solving problems with money, which is interesting because it's always a lot of what I say is about, if there's a problem that money is that, where money's the only problem, then it's not a real problem. But apparently there's a dark side to it. So I'm really interested to find out about that. And she's also going to talk about, if we have time, how to embrace financial paranoia. And I don't know anybody who's going through that at all, ever. And whatever else can come up. So who is our guest today? Our guest today, her name is Emily Guy Birkin. And she's a former educator and lifelong money nerd, which I love that phrase. She's a money nerd, which I should have more money nerds in my life, in my team, who specialize in scientific research behind irrational money behaviors, aka money anxiety, and those things that keep us stuck, right, financially. Now, her background in education allows her to make complex financial topics relatable and easily understood by the layperson. She is the author of three other books, the one called The 5 Years Before You Retire, Choose Your Retirement. I'm thinking about 5 years from retiring. That'd be nice, right? Making Social Security Work for You. I need to give that book to my mom. And she has also appeared on Huffington Post, Business Insider, Kiplinger's, MSN Money, and the New York Times Online. So excited to have you on the show. Welcome to the show, Emily Guy Birkin.
Hey. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
I know. I forgot to give you an applause. That, you know. there it is. Emily Guy Birkin on the show today. Okay, that applause is just way too long. You guys can calm down now. We have a show to run. Shh, 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 shh. Okay. Now we're back on. So, how are you? And where
I'm
are you calling
great.
From? Yeah. Sorry, that was a long intro. It's longer than normal because we had some technical difficulty, but that's okay. We jumped right into the appropriate soundtrack just for you. So anyway,
I love it. The Imperial March is my soundtrack. That yeah, sounds good. It's,
well, you know, I actually have a client who his ringtone for his wife is the Imperial Tone.
Oh no.
And I said, really? But they said, no, but she knows that is my favorite soundtrack. I was like, you know, that's for the dark side, right? He goes, well, there are moments. I'm like, oh my God. But yeah, welcome to the show. I mean, I'm so excited because you and I talk a lot of the same language. You have a little bit more academic approach, and I'm more about the mental, emotional release, the deeper money story stuff, the stuff that we kind of grow up with before we entered into the world of academics. So interested in seeing how we can play today and talk about what it is all that you do. So the thing I want to kind of like get out of the way, because the Money Lab, we always talk about, you know, every guest that comes on the Money Lab, we always first get talk about their money story. Let's get their money story out of the way. And apparently you have one.
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about that. What was your money story that you grew up with?
So growing up, I learned from a very small childhood that a problem that can be solved with money isn't a real problem.
I say that all the time.
Yeah.
Did we have the same childhood? Did we grow up in the same house?
I don't think so.
Really?
So this came down from my great grandmother, apparently. My great grandmother, who passed away before I was born, would teach it to my grandmother, who taught it to my mother, who taught it to me and my sister.
Totally passed down, right?
And so we basically, so an example of it was, when I was in high school, I don't know if you remember, in the 90s, everyone had to have a graphing calculator for their high school math classes.
Yes, and, the
TI-86, whatever it was.
Yeah,
and those things, they weren't cheap. They were like $120, $130.
Yeah.
And mine was stolen out of my backpack that was in the locker room while I was in gym class. Because the locker room did not have locks on their lockers, and just didn't occur to me that that would be
Have to bring your own?
Not safe place.
Right, exactly. It's actually, it is. I mean, that's a lot of things get stolen in school. Did it have a place to put a lock on though?
I think there was a place to put a lock on it. I don't remember, but so at the time, I remember money must have been a little bit tight for my mom and my stepfather, because my stepfather was a little frustrated about having to spend the money. Mm-hmm. And I was actually feeling, it was the first time I ever had something stolen from me. Mm-hmm. And so there was this feeling of violation.
Yeah.
And also the fact that they were in the girls' locker room, that it could have been a girl, could have been a boy who stole it, but just someone who wasn't, you know, in my class was in the locker room when
really
I was there.
Needed the graphing calculator.
Yeah. So, and my mom very much was like, okay, solving the problem of you needing a new graphing calculator, that's easy. It just takes money. Now, like, I know my stepfather was a little worried about the money, but, you know, the focus was on, it just takes money. That's something that we can do. You know, we might have to rearrange this, that, the other financially, but we can do that. We can replace that. The fact that Emily is feeling uncomfortable and a little violated, that is the real problem, because we can't solve that with money. And so that's kind of an example of how I was raised to view this. And it was very helpful to me.
Wow.
Because it was like, okay, so the graphing calculator problem, because I was kind of getting in a anxiety about it, about having to pay for it, and the feeling of being a little bit violated.
And guilty and also, because your stepfather was like getting all a little bent out of shape about it too, right?
Yes, yeah. So wow. I had like these anxious feelings, and my mom, because of this saying that's been passed down from our family from way back,
right,
was able to help me separate out what was the real problem, which was like my feeling of anxiousness, both in that, you know, someone had stolen my thing,
right,
and like worried that I was upsetting my stepfather and things like that, and the
it's
not
all
real
kinds
problem,
of emotions,
which is,
right,
you know, buying a new calculator.
But that's such an enlightened outlook on money though your mom had. I mean, that's not a common thing. Because
yes.
I know most of society, as my parents included, put so much weight on money that there's so much guilt around simply asking or having to replace things. There's so much emotional angst around it. I mean, you said your grandma, your great-grandmother had it and passed that belief down. How was that? Was it a a lifelong generations of entrepreneurs, or what was it that was, how do they have that kind of insight? Because that's not a common insight.
I have a feeling that my great-grandmother, her name was Fanny.
Fanny Mae?
No, not Fanny Mae. Fanny Guys.
That's an awesome name. So Fanny Guys, that's awesome.
I have some ridiculous names in my family. My dad was Jim Guy, not related. These are two separate sides. So I had a guys on one side and guy on the other side. And my dad
what?
Growing up was, yeah.
Guys and crazy. Guys. So there's a plural and then there's a singular.
Yes.
That's awesome.
And my dad growing up, his name was Jim Guy, but growing up he was known as Butch Guy. Oh. Only in the 1950s.
Of course, James, Jim, and then Butch, right? I mean, that's the next derivative off of Jim.
Sure.
James, Jim. I thought everybody knew that.
It's like Peggy for Margaret, you know?
I was like, what? It's like someone at a party said, I can't pronounce your name, can I just call you Steve? Okay, yeah, that's a logical derivative. Yeah, makes sense. Totally. Call me Steve. It happened. That's a true story.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. No, that's not where Butch came from. I think my grandmother just liked it for some reason. I didn't think about the fact that Butch Guy was a really weird name.
Look at that guy. He's kind of a Butch Guy.
Yeah.
It's like, exactly. You mean, was he a girl? I mean, no, he's just a Butch guy. Yeah, Butch.
So, yeah, he, by the time he was 14, he insisted on being called Jim instead. So.
He's like, enough. I've had 14 years of this. Enough.
No more.
Names are a funny thing. So anyway, back to your money story.
So yeah, my great-grandma Fanny, the stories that we hear, I would hear about her was that if she had not been born a woman at the time that she was born, let's see, my grandmother was born in the 19-teens, so Fanny would have been in the late 19th century, so like 1880s, 1890s, okay. Around there. So if she had been born a man, she would have gone into high finance, is the story that the family tells.
Okay.
And so she was always very, very good with money, and she did like a version of like the cash envelope system, except she used her purses. And so when she passed away, they were going through her things and they found over $4,000 in all of her various purses, because in each purse in her head, she'd be like, okay, so this is the purse for my grandchildren's gifts. This is the purse for holidays. This is the purse for going on vacation. This is the purse for an emergency fund.
Wow.
And so she had all this money just kind of squirreled away. And so at that sort of thing, I think, really, because she was so skilled with money, that's part of the reason why she came up with this, like, a problem that can be solved with money is not a real problem.
Right.
And then also living through the early 20th century,
sure.
And even seeing so many huge, like, seismic changes in the world, you know,
right.
World War I, World War II, you know, civil rights movement, all of these things, and
right.
Seeing, you know, like, these are problems that no one can solve with money.
It's like the tail end of the Industrial Revolution, wasn't it? Like,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's so much that she lived through to be able to understand, like, yeah, they're like a problem that I can solve with money. That's not like, you know, poverty or injustice or war or
right.
death. These are like,
it's like perspective, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great perspective. And so that's what I grew up with. And it was really helpful to me in kind of creating my worldview when it comes to money.
Yeah. I mean, the cash envelope system. I mean, explain to our audience what that is, the cash envelope system.
So cash envelope system is, you'll often hear like Dave Ramsey being a proponent of it, but it's actually just kind of a very old fashioned way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before people had bank accounts and things like that, you would plan ahead with cash for whatever you'd need over the month or you know, even the year potentially. And so you'd have one envelope that would be your grocery envelope. And so, and you'd put, you know, $100 a week or however much in that. And so once you'd spend everything in that grocery envelope, you were done. You couldn't buy any more until you got your next paycheck. So similarly, you might have one for insurance, for rent, for you know, pet care,
okay.
for transportation, those
right.
sorts of things. So whatever it is that you are going to need, you plan ahead that, okay, so I know that I generally spend about this much on groceries, so
right.
I plan ahead and I put this aside in the grocery envelope, and then you can't get into trouble by taking money out of a different bucket, basically,
right?
By overspending.
Yeah, and if you have so many envelopes that you stop, like, because you have one big envelope, it's like, oh, I'll just dip into that one. But if you have multiple envelopes, you're like, whoa, where do I dip? I can't dip. I'm not supposed to dip. What am I doing here? You know, it's so interesting that you said, because it's very similar to what I talk about with my students and clients about, you know, developing a ledger. So giving money a directory so that you don't wait till money comes in to figure out what to do with it. You already give a direction. Because if money is energy and needs to flow, if you make it wait, it will actually go away. You know, it will go in directions that you didn't want it to go, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Well, and it's very helpful. You know, something I talk about in End Financial Stress Now is the studies, the academic studies into how we view money. One of the things that we do is something called mental accounting, mm-hmm. which is we kind of keep a running tally in our head of like, okay, so this is about how much I've got in my checking account. This is about how much I've got in cash. This is about how much I've got in the savings.
That's the best way ever.
Yeah. So we have these mental accounts, and we assign different roles. So, for instance, if you get a tax refund in April, that is a different mental account than what you get from your paycheck. So that's part of the reason why people are more willing to splurge with their tax refunds than they are with their paychecks, because their paycheck's their paycheck. You know, you got to pay the Visa bill, you got to pay rent or mortgage,
it's for
survival.
You know, you
got to pay for your child's orthodonture. Yeah. Whereas, like, when you get a refund in April from Uncle Sam, you're like, woohoo, free money!
Go on vacation!
Yeah, this is actually your money that came from your paychecks.
Right.
You're getting back.
So it's like a mindset shift. It's like the perspective has been like kind of lost.
One of the reasons why I personally like the kind of envelope system is that it takes the mental part of accounting out of the process. It's mm-hmm. no longer mental accounting. It's just accounting. And then that way you're able to make more rational choices with your money. And it's easier to recognize that found money is not really found money that's free for you to spend on whatever. It's actually, you know, all part of your budget, your mm-hmm. money, and you can make better choices with it. Or, you know, I don't have a problem with people splurging, but choosing to splurge rather than it being like a reactive
type of circumstance, like when this money comes in, I am going to splurge on XYZ versus mm-hmm. like, oh, money's here. That's kind of what I'm saying. It's like when money, if you wait till money comes in before you decide what to do with it, then there's a tendency, because we are emotional beings, to just mm-hmm. react first emotionally about it and then look back and it's like, oh, that might not have been a good idea. Why did I do that? You
know? Yeah, so, absolutely.
So having grown up in such a cool belief system, were you always good with money then, or were there times where in your process of growing, like, oh, well, that doesn't work, or you certain belief systems still kind of eked in there? I mean, what was the dark side that we're talking about?
So I have always been kind of a money nerd, and I actually I kind of think there might be some genetic component to it, like I think that or reincarnation or something, because I'm very much like my grandma Fanny in the way that I deal with money and handle money.
Nice.
And like with my grandma Fanny, it's just kind of innate in who I am, because uh-huh. she did not go to school for finance. I never went to school for finance. This has just always like been how I deal with things. Uh-huh. Although my father was a financial planner, so I did, you know, pick some stuff up there.
Sure.
So part of where I see the dark side to this this viewpoint came from the fact that I tend to be very frugal, and that's just who I am. I'm a frugal person. Uh-huh. Whereas my family is not necessarily frugal. Mm. And so there would be some kind of pushback when I would be like, oh, well, you know, I don't want to spend money on this, that, or the other. And there would be kind of, in my family, like the opposite of, frugal would be generous, I think, whereas I don't think right. that those, I think those can coexist, but there was this sense that if you're being frugal, you're not being generous, and being generous is very important in my family. So there was a little bit of that. And then the other like really big one that I saw was in 2012. My mom, you know, who I learned this lesson from, that money, a problem that can be solved with money is not a real problem. She got very sick. Mm-hmm. She got pneumonia and had to go into a medically induced coma for about a week. She's completely recovered now and is fine, but it was really tough time for us.
Sure.
Now, my mom owned a business for 40 years. She owned an art gallery. And my sister was lived closer than I did. And my sister was trying to keep my mom's gallery afloat and trying to handle all these things that were going on while my mom was ill. And there was a day when my sister called me, like, just really freaking out, like, you know, well, there's this, that, and the other that needs to be taken care of at the gallery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to cost money. And I know a problem that can be solved with money isn't a real problem, but I don't know what to do. And, like, the dark side of this viewpoint was it was putting pressure on my sister, a kind of emotional pressure on her to be like, the real problem is mom is sick, and the it's not a real problem that I'm trying to keep the gallery afloat while she's sick. Mm. And like, no, that is a real problem. Yes, that could be solved with money, but if you don't have the money to solve that problem, then that's not a problem that can be solved with money.
Right.
And so that's something that I have seen, not just there, but in, you know, at other points in my family life, where because we've internalized this idea, you know, well, it shouldn't be a problem, so I am not allowed to be stressed about this because that's not the real problem. I need to be focused on the real problem, which is mom being sick. And it's like, well, there's a bunch of problems going on right now. And
well, yeah, I mean, I would say another problem is, why isn't there enough revenue flow to cover for whatever is going on? Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so wow.
And it was a really tough time. And I just remember, like, at that point, you know, my sister called. I kind of helped her to feel a little bit better. And at the time, my best friend was staying with me I was in Baltimore, which is where I'm from originally. Mm-hmm. I was in Baltimore to see my mom, and my best friend had come to stay with me, to stay with my son, because he couldn't come to the hospital with me. Right. And so I got off the phone with my sister, and I was telling my best friend, like, wow, this is really a double-edged sword. You know, this sense, like, you know, this very cool viewpoint that we grew up with is causing Tracy more stress, because she feels like she's letting mom down because she's allowing herself to be stressed by a money problem.
Right. Do you think it's because it's oversimplistic, the belief that if it can't be solved with money? I mean, because I know when I talk about this with my students and clients, we have to go deeper into the layers of it. I mean, we have to define what a problem is. We define what kind of money are we talking about, money that you have or money that you go out and you make. Mm-hmm, because, mm-hmm. I mean, I know one of the things that we talk about all the time is that if it's just, you know, it's the follow-up to what I say. If money's the only problem, it can solve the problem, then it's not a real problem. And then my follow-up is just go make more money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And that puts you in a different solution state of mind, right?
Yes, absolutely. And it's... you know, I will say my husband absolutely hates this saying. Like,
I think really most people do, because it's hard to grasp.
Yes.
He says, what are you talking about? Money is a big problem. It's like, no, no.
Mm-hmm. and it also, it really highlights the difference in how he and I were raised. Mm-hmm. I grew up, you know, my family wasn't, I wouldn't say affluent or anything like that. There were, you know, but my grandmother was there to help my mom. Mm-hmm. When my mom was a single mother for quite some time. My parents divorced when I was 3. And so, you know, I know that she struggled financially. But I never felt it as a child. I never felt her financial struggles, you know. Whereas my husband was not nearly as lucky. He definitely felt his family's financial struggles growing up. Mm-hmm. And some of that, I will say, comes from the attitude of the parents. Like, my mom came from the attitude of problem can be solved with money is not a real problem. So that kind of gave this protective bubble over me and my sister. Right. Even when she was personally struggling, she did not let it show, because she felt like, I can solve it, I can make more money, I can do this.
Right.
Whereas I think the stress really affected all the members of my husband's family when he was growing up. So he kind of internalized the idea money is the source of problems. Money is the source of stress.
So how do you manage that, though? I mean, you being a money nerd and being married to somebody who grew up with that, which is actually more common than some being married to someone who's another money nerd. I mean, how did you guys know? Because I'm sure there's a lot of couples in the audience that say, well, I get it, but my significant other doesn't get it, you know, and is not willing to get it, or whatever the case may be. How did you navigate that? Are you still navigating it in terms of,
each case is relitigated.
Yeah.
It's not quite that bad, but it's something we're still working towards, and I think as with any couples, like, you kind of come to compromises. Some of the things that I came into our relationship with, I've changed, and some things he's changed.
Right.
So he's gotten more comfortable with taking something that could be a financial risk. And I've gotten a little more conservative in some things.
But you were always frugal, though. How did you become more frugal, or I mean,
I have become more willing to shop around for certain things. One thing, I've always been frugal, but I've also always really liked convenience.
And I would pay so much for convenience. I don't know about you, but that's...
And there are some things that I was actually just earlier today lamenting to some other parents of my son's elementary school. They used to have a process, like, for the back to school supplies. You could send them $50 and there'd be a box waiting for the kid on the first day.
Nice.
And the funny thing is, I love office supplies, but the specifics of what they want is overwhelming to me.
Yeah. It's like the store is so big.
Take my money. I'll just throw my purse at you, whatever. Right. I don't have to deal with.
It's a time thing too, right? I think one of the things that increases your awareness of just how valuable time is the statement that if it's a problem that can be solved with money, then great, solve it, get it done quick. So the more valuable commodity, such as time, can be better utilized. I mean, you're an entrepreneur. Is your husband an entrepreneur too?
No, he's actually a mechanical engineer.
Oh, okay. I was an engineer. I went to school as an engineer, so I get it. I grew up in a household of engineers, basically.
He's very much got an engineering mindset in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's funny because my money nerdery, I would think, would fit with his engineering mindset.
Ideally, right? Because it's very left brain still. The way you approach money is so much more left brain than me, and which is so ironic because I'm computer science engineer. I'm so engineer from growing up, and then here I am, like, no, I'm going this other way. But you would think that because of the money nerd in you is and the systems and the processes that you use and you tout, go kind of hand in hand with engineering concepts if you think about it, except it has to do with money versus, you know, mechanical or physics or something like that.
Instead of pistons and
right, exactly,
and oil viscosity and things like that.
Viscosity breakdown, I know that from the commercial. Valvoline, I think it is.
I was actually just talking to him about that commercial recently. I was like, is that realistic?
It's amazing. I mean, you get the right words down and you pump it into people's minds enough. It just sticks with you.
And it stays.
And now I know Valvoline. Valvoline, I just gave you a free plug. Viscosity breakdown, engines, good for the... Whatever, you know. So anyway. But yeah, I mean, I'm curious as to how you blend the different types of left-brainness, if you will. Mm-hmm. And how do you... How do you justify with him anyway the importance and value of convenience? Mm-hmm. Because I know growing up in an engineering household, it's always about no one can do a better job than yourself. You do it yourself mm-hmm. type of thing, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, part of it is like just kind of letting him off the hook in some ways. So because he's a mechanical engineer in automotive engineering.
Oh, wow.
He was building his own car when he was like 5. I'm exaggerating only slightly.
Yeah. 6.
He feels this very strong urge that he has to do all of the work on our cars. Mm-hmm. And I feel very lucky that I have someone who is able to do that. And mm-hmm. like, he's got the skill, he's got the most of the tools, but he does not have the time.
Right.
And there are some things where he's like, oh, I do not want to do this job because it's going to be a real pain in the neck. And so from early on, I've been like, well, then don't do it.
Let's pay someone else to do it.
We can find a mechanic who you trust and have them do it. And it's worth the time. And slowly, I mean, we've been married 10 years. We've been together 15. Slowly over 15 years, he's come to like, oh, yeah, I really can like reclaim my Saturday afternoon and not spend the entire time
right
like, up to my elbows in grease.
I know, especially if you've got a four-year-old and a seven-year-old. Wait, three-year-old, seven-year-old?
Seven-year-old, four-year-old and a seven-year-old.
Four-year-old, yeah. Seven-year-old. I mean, those are some critical times to be able to spend with the kids. You know,
yeah,
when you're home,
yeah,
you should
absolutely
be doing that, right?
And that's that sort of thing has kind of helped to like, that's one of the ways that he's become, I won't say more of a financial risk, but he's more willing to recognize how much his time is worth.
Yeah.
Why, you know, like, doing everything himself is not, like, the ideal standard that he should be striving for. Because mm-hmm. He very much internalized this sense, like, you have to do it all yourself.
Right.
In part because that was the reality for growing up, is, like,
right,
his parents had to take on a lot of the jobs that they either didn't have the inclination or the interest mm-hmm. in doing, because they simply didn't have the money to contract it out.
Yeah. And, you know, and I found that in the work that I do on my end, is that not willing to honor the time or the value of your time can contribute to anxiety around money, can contribute to, as you would call it, financial paranoia. I mean, do you find that to be the case? I'm someone who doesn't realize just how valuable their time is and insist on just to save a few pennies here and there, it will actually mm-hmm. impact your money flow. I mean, do you find that to be the case with the work that you do?
Yeah, I do. So I've been a freelance writer for, it's going on 8 years now.
Wow.
And so
that's how you're able to crank out so many books, because you write for a living. I was like, wondering, God, how do I get about more books like that?
Yeah, it's what I do. And I like, I've actually always, in addition to being a money nerd, I've always been a writer. No,
wow,
I've not always written about money. But, you know, from the time
trashy
I was
novels?
Little,
I can't believe it's
actually,
not butter.
Yes. Wow. I would love to write trashy novels.
Let the inner you, the frugal you, just kind of open up and just start to write about all your fantasies. I want to read that book.
So one of the things that I learned early on, I did the newbie freelancer mistake of saying yes to any offer, no matter how low the price was. It was really unpleasant.
Right.
I mean, so I was taking jobs that were not worth my time.
Right.
The amount of money that I was getting was just so little. And that helped me to it took me a while to feel comfortable calling myself a writer, because everything that I wrote was on a blog. And mm-hmm. I was born in 1979, so I'm not a millennial. I'm on that cusp. Mm-hmm. I'm the Oregon Trail generation.
Is that what we are, the Oregon Trail generation?
That's what I've heard. Is like, they say Xennial. I don't like that one. I like Oregon Trail generation, because we all grew up with that in elementary school.
Yeah, and that game. You ever play that game, Oregon Trail?
Yeah.
So you did play the game. You are a nerd. Oh, that's awesome. That was the best game ever. It was like story, you know. Yeah, anyway, so... For those who don't know, that's the game.
So, in part because of my age, when I first started writing and getting paid for my writing, everything uh-huh. was appearing on blogs. And because I could remember those live journal blogs from when the internet was still new, and like they had the horrible graphics and the bright green and red contrast and stuff like that, in my head I was like, this is not legitimate writing. And I had a hard time even calling myself a writer for a while. And so that was part of the reason why I had trouble valuing my time enough to say, no, I bring a lot to the table. I've got I've got a bachelor's degree in creative writing from a really good school. I have a background in education, which means that I'm excellent at knowing how to get this information out to people in a way that is going to make the most sense.
Yes.
Maybe I don't have as long a background in money, but in terms of like being able to put it on a resume, but I've been reading and thinking and doing,
it's like generational years. For you.
Yeah.
It's not even.
I've got the personal experience, just not the academic experience.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. What's the academic side of money really is actually could be a hindrance, I found. Because mm-hmm. most of the academic learned behavior, I mean, yeah, the fundamentals of there of how financial, how to balance your checkbook, how to do P&Ls and everything like that. But to truly understand the emotional drivers behind money, the energy behind mm-hmm. money, that's not taught in mm-hmm. schools. You know, that's something that is passed down through generation to generation mm-hmm. or through, mm-hmm. in my case, through trials and tribulation, falling flat in your face so many times that you want to kill yourself type of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think that is, those are the true teachers of what money mm-hmm. is like, because money, in essence, is just another representation of man's blood, sweat, toil, tears, energy. That's just an easier way for us to exchange what we put into our products and services, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to traveling months and months to kind of go to a chicken farmer versus an apple farmer and say, okay, I want chickens. It says, well, you got to go that way now. You know, money just made it easier. Yeah, you know, money is supposed to be the facilitator, right? And I mm-hmm. think that area is best learned through things outside of academia, because mm-hmm. academics might put a handicap to your ability to kind of challenge the belief systems that keep people stuck.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Absolutely. That's one thing. Kind of my intro to understanding mm-hmm. finance was actually reading. I'm an avid reader. I've always been someone who just
you
kind
should
of
if you're a writer.
Books.
I'm a writer, but I don't read. Can you imagine? but anyway, yeah, what was the book?
One of the things I, in addition to fiction, which I love, mm-hmm. I've always really been interested in sociology, and just the study of why people do what they do. Mm. And that kind of led me into the study of behavioral economics, which is, kind of rethinking the old view of rational economics mm-hmm. and, Homo economicus, as they call him, is always rational, always figures out the most utility.
Homo economicus,
money.
I like that.
Yeah, that's what classical economists think that human beings are like, is that human beings will, when presented with options, sit there and think through which one's going to be best for them instead of having a gut emotional reaction. And so behavioral economics has come from this place of wait a minute, no, human beings don't do that.
No, they emotionally make a decision first, then they logically try to find a way to validate it.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And so a lot of the sociological stuff that I was reading about the emotional reasons behind our thought processes kind of led me into well, wait a minute, that's happened to me when I've been spending money. Because I'm someone who's always been a money nerd. I've always been very good with money and frugal. And there have been times when I'm like, why on earth did I make that financial decision? And I'll realize because of the way the marketing went.
Right. Yeah. You got emotionally drawn. It's like, holy cow, did I really click on that Instagram ad and buy that? It's terrible. It came from China. Oh, it's not even what I ordered. That just happened, actually. It's a little fresh. It's a fresh wound.
Yeah, I mean, those sorts of things. And even when you know better, mm-hmm. you it's very easy to still fall victim to those sorts of things. And that was, I was fascinated with that kind of thing. And then kind of how it scales up, it starts with, con artists and salespeople, people who are trying to convince you of something,
right.
Politicians are fully aware of how human beings react emotionally and they use it.
Right.
And it's taken, until it's behavioral economics as a field is only about 40 or 50 years old. It's taken until recently for academia to catch up and go, hey, wait a minute.
We've been teaching it all wrong. Oh my God. No, I got to tell you, I mean, I have a, I had a client who was an Ivy League graduate, MBA and stuff like that. And what he learned about money through me, he goes, they don't teach this in school. I feel like I wasted all my money. He says, no, you need fundamental systems and processes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If they taught this stuff that I'm telling you right now too early, then it would actually throw monkey wrenches in all kinds of different directions. Mm-hmm. But at least, you know, I mean, and I said, well, I mean, and I got to find a way to justify him spending so much money on his MBA. but I mean, so a lot of that then it starts to explain why there's so much financial anxiety and financial stress around money, you know, in people's mm-hmm. lives, even to this day, despite all the studies and everything that we do around it. So in your book, let's talk about your book and financial financial stress now, right? Because mm-hmm. my book is called Healing Your Money Anxiety. But your book is called End Financial Stress. So we should actually have like a book signing party. Or no, we should have a book signing party where we have, you know, both sides of the brain being managed, you know, on the same aspect, talking about the same thing but in different ways, you know.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I know, right? We should do something. I think we should
totally nerding out.
I know. That's like cocktail. We're talking about process. So let's talk about your process. How do you help people? How do you help your audience end financial stress now? You know, mm-hmm. because there's an immediacy, I think, I'm feeling from the way you do it, so that people don't have to wait a lifetime to end it. They can end it now. So let's talk about your book and what that helps people do.
So for ending financial stress, like the first thing I need people to understand is that a lot of times people think that the end of financial stress is the end of financial problems. And that's not true.
Right.
There's never going to be any amount of money that you could have that will end your financial problems.
Biggie Smalls would say, more money, more problems.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That is exactly the problem. And like, so, you know, even Warren Buffett has financial problems he has to deal with. They're different. They're different from like, my car broke down and I don't know how to get to work.
Right.
But there are still financial problems.
Right.
So that's the first thing I want people to understand is like, you can end your stress even if you still have financial problems.
Right. I agree.
And so that's, yeah. I mean, and then the other thing I want people to understand is there are some financial problems that are so big that they cannot be solved by any one individual in mm-hmm. their own life. You know, there's some things that we need to fix as a society to be able to end financial stress on a like larger scale. But any one person can ease their stress at the very least.
Right. So that, stressing about world hunger is probably not a good thing to do all the time, because there's gonna it's bigger, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And having that be a daily money. Stress, like, I'm totally stressed about world hunger right now. It's like, yeah, that's a it's a little bit too big. Why don't you take care of your own financial stress? I love what you're talking about here. It's because it's so validating, you know. Sometimes I feel, I don't know if you ever feel this or not, sometimes I feel like I'm on my own island, and sometimes I'm saying things that is so cryptic that nobody seems to understand. Like, am I the only one that's talking this way? Am I the only one that thinks this way about money?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So I love that you're validating so many things. Like, oh my God, there's somebody else out there that's speaking the same language. This is so cool. You know, I don't know if you ever feel that way, but I certainly do. I mean,
no,
a lot of times.
I definitely do, because it took me a while. I think I was in my 30s before I truly understand that my view of money is different from how most people look at it.
Yeah.
Like, I always knew that I thought it was because I was interested in money and most people aren't, and that like, I really truly enjoy balancing my checkbook. I mean, like light a candle, pour a glass of wine, let's get started.
Okay,
you know, put on some Barry White.
So that's where you and I differ a little bit. I'm not a big fan of the whole balancing thing. I love uncovering people's stories around money mm-hmm. and their emotional charge around money, and I can have conversations about that all day long. But you yeah. sit me down and I was like, you're gonna be taking glasses of wine, I'll be taking shots, okay? And then I'll be like, okay, now I'll do it. I mean, it's like, holy cow, it's like, really? Can I pay somebody to do this?
So you know, the fact that I like, because I've met my people, I've met my tribe of uh-huh. there are other people who really enjoy like the dollars.
Oh,
and
I'm
cents,
sure.
Like,
no,
that
I know
kind
that.
Of stuff. and I always assumed that's what made me different, was the fact that I really enjoyed like that aspect of it. But no, it really is. There's a mental difference also mm-hmm. In that. For me, I have kind of always seen money problems as like a game of Tetris.
Oh yeah.
And some of that comes from the fact that, again, that I grew up in this very protected bubble where, uh-huh. like, I didn't feel the financial stress my parents might have felt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I'm like, oh, okay, I've got a larger than I realized cell phone bill this month. So this is, you know, back when I was first out on my own. And my, you know, your cell phone bill, if you went over your minutes, was through the roof.
I was on cell phones before they even had plans. You just paid right from the get-go.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God. Every month was like, what is this?
Early adopter.
I know. I had a backpack and everything to carry it.
So when I was first out on my own and I went over my minutes and larger than a cell phone bill than I anticipated, where can I get this money from, you know, to pay this? So like, okay, if I take $10 out of my grocery budget and if I do this out of here and maybe borrow some out of my savings, I can get that paid off. So how will I reimburse the savings? Because everything else I can just, you know, buy just tuna fish and ramen, you know, for a week. So. For you know, that sort of thing. So and
tuna fish and ramen. It just sounds.
Actually, I never ramen? Ate them together. But.
Are you sure? Tuna fish and ramen. So you eat them separately? I've done that. Never mind. Yeah, I've actually done that. Forget what I said.
So for me, like it's kind of a satisfying mental game.
Sure.
In that it's like Tetris for me.
It's like money Sudoku.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So like I get a charge out of figuring out how to make it work. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's something that I can necessarily teach to other people because that is just how I'm wired.
Right.
But yeah. Teaching like being able to get that satisfaction out of it is, I think, unique to me. But being able to view it as, okay, how do I rearrange? Well, let's look at this as a game of Tetris, even if it's, you know, more fraught Tetris than it is for me, is an easier way of looking at it rather than we tend to get into these emotional spirals like, right. Oh my goodness, I went, you know, this bill is too much. I don't know how I'm going to pay it. Like I'm a bad person because I can't handle
you
my
start
money.
Start beating yourself stress, up. Stress, right,
stress.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So people so often internalize and make it about how like, oh, I don't understand money and I never will and I'll never get ahead and like this negative self-talk. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing where like we need to kind of put a pin in that and just be like, no, that is not helpful. That is not rational. That is not going to make you better with money. Like a lot of times we feel like right. shaming ourselves will make us better at whatever it is we're shaming ourselves about.
Right.
When, you know, if you just be like, okay, I'm going to let that emotional side over here, just let it stay over here. And I'm going to turn my rational brain into this game of Tetris and figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then if I need to, then I can feel how I need to feel about the fact that I had to take money out of my vacation fund and I'm not mm-hmm. going to be able to go on the vacation I want, you know, right. or something like that. And it's not an easy thing to do, but kind of drawing that line between, you know, figuring this out as just a dollars and cents problem mm-hmm. and then letting yourself feel about it can do a lot to help you feel less stressed.
Wow. And so it sounds like a lot of your book isn't so much about the budgeting and the strategies. There's a lot of behavioral type mm-hmm. of social components to it, you know, to mm-hmm. helping people understand how that what that stress is all about. And then and do you basically come to the conclusion at the end, it's not so much the money, it's something else that's causing that stress or is the source of that stress?
Yeah, absolutely. It's
you obviously guide them through to get there. It's not
yeah.
like you just
well,
throw it in their
what,
face.
What I want to help people understand is the better they know themselves about, you know, just who they are as people, the better they will be able to handle their money. You know, what I start the book with is is what do you believe about money?
Right.
Like, what does money mean to you? Because that's the other thing that's really weird about money. It's this weird construct that we all have together decided is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, so like it's little green pieces of paper. Like you can't eat it. You can't build a house out of it. You can't wear it.
You can eat it. It's good fiber, but it's just it's dirty fiber.
It's dirty and tastes gross. I know. But and like you better serve buying something with it.
It's like, I'm so hungry, I can't even get myself to buy something with this money. I'm just going to eat it. Can you imagine?
Exactly.
So, yeah.
It's this weird social construct that doesn't occur in nature. Mm-hmm. And so because it is this thing that we've decided together is valuable, we tend to put our own meaning on it.
But it represents something in nature, though, doesn't it? It doesn't exist in nature, but it represents something in nature. I mean, if you look at animals and how they interact, there's always some kind of an exchange in order to determine usually it's fighting, you know? Money is a great way to not fight, but yet we're still fighting. What's wrong with us? I mean, it's like...
Well, and there's like, it does kind of in some ways represent, like, there are hierarchies in nature and things like that.
Photosynthesis. I give you sun, I give you rain, and you give me oxygen.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I give you money, you give me an air tank.
So there are some parallels. Yeah. But ultimately it's a human construct that kind of parallels things that happen in nature. Right. It's not a direct one-to-one. And that's because of that, we tend to put emotional and moral viewpoints on money, and those and that's the thing is, that's fine. It's just that we don't recognize it.
Yeah.
So we'll say something like, and this one I'm guilty of, we'll say like, oh, he's filthy rich. Wait, what?
What?
Filthy?
He's
what
dirty.
What does that mean?
And so unless you like filthy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you have this like little thing about being filthy, it's like,
yeah.
That's a whole different conversation.
We got it on the other side too, though. Like, he's filthy rich, she's dirt poor.
Yeah.
So like we kind of put our own construct of what it means to have or not have
money,
onto money. And if we know that we do that, then we can kind of correct for the beliefs that are not helpful to us.
Right.
And we can kind of embrace the beliefs that do help us to live our best lives.
Right.
But if you're not examining your money beliefs, you're just going to keep going down that same path where you're making these decisions based on these unexamined beliefs that are possibly keeping you poor. Or if not poor, they might be keeping you away from your family. If, for instance, you believe money is love, you might feel like, well, I have to take all this overtime. I have to, hustle
as an
entrepreneur to make sure I can keep my family and all this money, whereas they're like, we'd love to have you home for dinner.
It's like, what? No, I don't have enough money to have that love.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's why it's so important to kind of like really grapple with what does money mean to you before you can even start anywhere else to get to that sense of like, who are you as a person?
Mm-hmm.
What are you trying to do? And is your money belief actually helping you achieve what you want in your life, or is it holding you back?
Right. So it's very much like a technology then, right? Mm-hmm. So I need to read your book, because I think it's, oh no, maybe I should write my book first and then I'll read your book. Otherwise you'll influence my book writing that I'm going away Labor Day weekend to just go in the cabin and just write.
Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah, because I can't, there's too much going on here. I was like, I can't finish this book here. I need to go away,
I know the feeling.
Right? I can't even imagine being a mom of two boys. I mean, how you get any writing done? But anyway, so I have a feeling that, I don't know if you ever speak on stage in them, but I'm looking to really put together a powerful stage where we have just talk. Imagine a whole entire weekend just talking about money.
Mm-hmm.
All the different facets of it. You're not allowed to talk about anything else. And it's kind of like man's last taboo, right? University College of London and their study, I'm sure you read that, where they had people, they thought it was going to be sex, but it actually ended up being money was the biggest challenge that people had with talking about it. So
yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. So we should definitely talk offline about that. And let's touch really quickly. Said I did say we were going to talk about the financial paranoia. What is that, financial paranoia?
So I think I mentioned my father was a financial planner, and he never quite said this in so many words, but he encouraged me always to embrace my own paranoia when it comes to finance.
Hmm.
So for instance, someone comes door to door soliciting. You never give money to anyone door to door. You don't know who they are. If there's someone is like offering like a too good to be true opportunity, like, you know, at the free lunch seminar and, you know, something like that. No, Emily, you never go to those. And I actually, my father, these were hard won lessons for him. He fell for a number of the like, oh, this sounds great sort of lunch seminars and you know, other too good to be true stuff. And as someone who's always been a little bit cautious around strangers, this fit real well with me. I was just like, great, I don't need to talk to anybody. but it's something I didn't realize that I had really internalized it until, again, my husband and I, when we were first living together, someone came door to door soliciting. She was saying that she was homeless and blah, 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 blah. And my husband gave her some money. And I was like, no, don't give any money to anyone door to door. You know, he's like, oh, but she's homeless. Cause I am someone who I do give money to homeless when I see them out and about, but I'm like, not when they know where I live and you don't know that that's truly who she is. And so it made me realize, like, he's someone I think of as very cautious, but he had not come to this embrace your paranoia. And so I find that that's like that's that sort of thing where, like, there's the door to door thing where I'm like, that's just a hard and fast rule because you don't know what's on the other side there. Then as for embracing your financial paranoia, it's also like when the Bernie Madoff scheme kind of fell apart. I remember reading about, you know, what he'd been doing and thinking, like, I'd like to believe I wouldn't have fallen for that because I would have been going, these returns are too good. What are you doing? Like, why are you doing this for me? Like, and so recognizing that no one is going to care about my money as much as I do, ever, is what I mean by embracing your financial paranoia. Is like, and one of the reasons why I say that is because so often people want to let go of dealing with their money. They want to have a financial planner, like, here, you deal with it, you make the decisions for me so I don't have to. And I want people to know, no, that's not a good idea. You need to be a little bit paranoid about anyone who has access to your financial information. Because they could be the greatest person in the world. They could be a fiduciary. Ultimately, they're not you. They're not going to have to live with the consequences of a bad decision. So it's up to you to have a little bit of paranoia, at least. And
a little bit, right? I mean, because overwhelming paranoia just freezes you and you can't do, do anything. So it's just like a moderate paranoia. Like a, I would see it almost, sounds like it's, what you're saying is make sure you do have a relationship with your money on some level. You're involved on some level. That there's a little bit of, well, you know, questioning of different things that you're doing. Paranoia is a pretty charged word. So
It's
kind of like, well, I don't want to be paranoid about my money.
for me, it's about, I don't ever feel comfortable with someone who seeks me out to help me with my money. And that's kind of like, that might sound paranoid to some people, but it's like, you know what? If I need something,
I will go
looking.
And
I feel the same way about any number of things. We had a hailstorm in the first house that my husband and I lived in, and someone came knocking door to door saying, like, we'll fix your hail damage and we'll deal with your insurance. And my husband actually talked to them. I was just like, no. We can contact our insurance. We can find a contractor. Anyone who's coming to us, there is something in it for them. And so that's kind of what I mean by it is you know when your paranoia is too strong. Like, if you're having trouble trusting someone you've sought out, that's not healthy. But recognizing that if you need something financially that's going to affect your money, you need to do the due diligence and you need to ultimately be the in charge of your money. I think of it, you know, after I had two kids, I had a birth doula with both kids. And I don't know if you know what a doula is, but
it's kind of like a midwife-ish type of
person. Yeah, she's there to be like the point person in between the laboring mom and dad and the medical team, so she can kind of go back and forth and explain things and help you out and be there, be your advocate.
She's a birthing Sherpa.
Yes, exactly. And I feel like you're anyone with financial who you deal with, who's your financial planner or anything like that, should be like a doula, in that you're the one who's doing all the work. Like, you are the one who's doing the labor and bringing this wealth into the world, to really stretch the metaphor.
Right.
Your financial doula is just there to help you understand things better and be your go-between with something bigger that you don't necessarily have access to. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that you should be at the center of this, not your financial planner or other professional.
Yeah. I think what that comes down to is really taking the time to understand your role in the flow of money, because there are people mm-hmm. who have no idea. And I think ignorance is not bliss when it comes to money, especially because mm-hmm. we live in a capitalistic world. Now, if we were living in a communistic socialistic world, then yeah, you could be, you know, blissfully ignorant about money because it's a different world. But we are currently living in a capitalistic world, so you kind of have to have a little bit of awareness. And so I think a lot of what you're saying is around making sure you have a relationship, identifying what type of role you play when it comes to your money, because if you're terrible at accounting, you shouldn't be touching, but at least understand the fundamentals and know what kind mm-hmm. of person to bring into your life mm-hmm. and do your due diligence around that. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a different time right now where we were just talking about this before the show. You can Google pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of... Back in the day, I mean, there was relevance in not door-to-door people. Otherwise, how do we learn about things? Because mm-hmm. without the door-to-door mm-hmm. people, we have no idea what was out there. But now things have shifted and things have changed mm-hmm. where you can do your own due diligence without having to deal with what comes to the door and just kind of deal with whatever show that comes up your way. It's turned mm-hmm. into a consumer-driven market versus how it was before, which was an advertising marketing-driven market where people get sold, 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 sold.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
if it was still that time, then this would be a different type of paranoia conversation we would be having probably.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you would have to actually pay attention to who comes out to your door, because otherwise you wouldn't know what's
yeah.
out there.
Well, and I kind of think of it as, again, because I'm a mom of small kids, like the amount of work that parents do to find like a babysitter or nanny, mm-hmm. you know, someone who's going to work with their kids, and they do less when it comes to who's going to be helping them with their money.
Which is ridiculous.
And, yeah. And so I'm not
Or they don't do it at all and they just don't do anything with it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's not doing anything with your money is not like leaving your, 3-month-old home alone.
It might be.
It's not the same thing.
It might be. If you just make them, I just leave it there, put it on the mattress. It's like, okay, yeah. what are you going to do with that? You know?
You want to make sure that you recognize the importance of money in your life
right.
is similar to the importance of your children in your life mm-hmm. And that you need to take care of it and make sure that you are doing the same kind of background checking for anyone who's going to be involved with your money that you would with anyone who's going to be working with your kids.
Right.
And that's the sort of thing where, like, when I kind of put it like that, people are like, oh, yeah. Because a lot of times people, they'll get a business card, because they through a friend, or mm-hmm. they'll go to a lunch seminar, or, get something through work, and then not do any other backup. They,
right.
They don't find someone else to compare. They don't look into, what questions to ask.
Right.
They just, because this is kind of opaque for a lot of people. A lot of people yeah. are like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what to do. So this guy seems nice. I'll go with him.
Well, there's that emotional piece right there, right? If the emotion, and
yeah.
then, the social piece in terms of recommendation, reviews, and everything. There's all kinds of different things that, and then this is all discussed in your book, right? This is all covered mm-hmm. in your book to some degree. Mm-hmm. Okay, very mm-hmm. cool. So, believe it or not, we're actually past the hour that we're actually supposed to be spending together. So, holy cow, this is a cool conversation. I have a sneaking suspicion we'll be talking more, because I love the piece that you brought to the table about it's important to get to know yourself. And that's why we always start every relationship we have with our students or our clients with an assessment. And I don't know if Jane, who referred us, told you about our assessment, but it's like a patented human assessment technology. It's based on your mm-hmm. physical thing. So it's really cool. But anyway, that being said, how do people get a hold of you? Do they just buy the book, they go on Amazon, or can they reach out to you? I mean, you don't do any kind of like other services other than writing your books and putting out there, do you? Or you do freelance writing?
Well, you can find me at my website, emilyguyburkin.com. Mm-hmm. And so you can find links to all four of my books there, and then also links to everything that I write. I appear online all over the place. I am primarily a writer. Ultimately, that is my
favorite thing to do. Like copywriting, too? Or?
is write and communicate.
Okay, so and you do copywriting as well, right?
And you can also always reach out to me on Twitter, at Emily Guy Birkin. And my books are available on Amazon and everywhere books are sold.
Everywhere books are sold. That's awesome. Everywhere there's a book, you'll find her. No. How about my closet? There's a book there.
That is true in terms of reading, but...
Right. Okay.
That's really true of my books.
So, very cool. Well, I'm really excited because I have a sneaking suspicion. I would love to have you come on maybe sometime as a co-host because this is such a cool... It's such a cool dynamic to be able to have the male and the female and coming from different times and still yet have very similar mindsets or perceptions around mm-hmm. money. You know, I'm sure we could probably discuss different things about it. But yeah, let's talk more offline. Make sure you hang around and debrief afterwards. But definitely, guys, go to EmilyGuyBirkin.com. Go to or you can tweet her. Tweet her at Emily Guy Birkin. At Emily Guy Birkin. Check out all her books. Her newest book is End Financial Stress Now. So if you're looking to end financial stress now, you want to get that book now by Emily Guy Birkin. Not guys. It's the singular. It's not the plural, right?
It's the singular guy, yes.
Singular guy. So definitely check it out. Okay, cool. So thank you so much for being on. Like I said, looking forward to talking about future engagements together in some shape or form because I love the fact that I don't feel like I'm alone talking this language and helping people understand. It can be lonely sometimes because I go out and I talk about it and people think I'm crazy or people say, yeah, that's stupid. I mean, who thinks about money like that, you know? Oh, yeah, it's so easy. Just go make more money. Seriously, if you can solve it, if money's the only reason why you're having this problem, then just make some money and solve it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and mm-hmm. I love how it's being backed up by this. And so I'm going to go buy your book. I'm going to go get your book and then make sure you sign it. And then we'll go from there. So awesome. So that's our show for this week, ladies and gentlemen. Again, if you found this episode to be valuable, if you didn't, you must have had it on mute and know of someone else that could benefit from what we talked about today, share it. Make sure to review us on iTunes or give us a thumbs up on YouTube Live. We are currently also now, yay, on Spotify. So you can check us out there as well. Just follow us there. Now, we even also have a Facebook group called The Money Lab. So join us there to dive even deeper into bad money story elimination strategies. Cool. So with that being said, that's a wrap. Have an amazing week to applying the knowledge from today, and we'll catch you next week on the Money Live podcast with a special guest. We don't know who yet, but we'll let you know. This is Wei from the Six Figure Academy and Emily Guy Birkin with the End Financial Stress Now book, author, mother, and humorist, signing off.